You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Wow, is it a Monday? Monday that feels like a Monday. No, not too bad. Glad to be with you this morning. Looking forward to the next couple of hours, getting our week started off right here on Breadbox Media. It is the feast day of Saints Cosmas and Damian. We'll talk about them a little later in the program. You hear their names, particularly in the longer form of the Mass. So we'll talk about them here in the second hour. Lisa Duffy will be my guest also at the bottom of the second hour. And Lisa, who's a regular monthly guest who blogs at A Million Unheard Souls, also who blogs at CatholicMatch.com. Lisa, who I got to know a number of years ago in my full-time work for the Catholic Diocese of Lexington. We were beginning a ministry to divorced persons, to divorced Catholics. And Lisa has had a significant ministry, wrote a book called Divorced Catholic, Now What? And got another book that's come out recently. She has been through that experience herself, and she writes with a lot of hope and a lot of grace and a lot of truth. And so it's always a pleasure to have Lisa on. And today we're going to talk about an article that she wrote in Catholic Match, How to Break the News to Others About Your Divorce. It's got to be a difficult thing. As she mentions, you know, there are a whole lot of different pathways people find themselves on to divorce. For some, it was never chosen. They were abandoned by their spouse, and yet they still find themselves in the difficult position of having to explain to others that their situation has changed. So we'll talk to her about that a little bit and just, you know, how to deal with suffering in your life when there is shame attached. So we'll talk about that. Also, latest from Charlotte, wondering what the devil would say about you and me. How calm thinking may have saved the world, and the glasses Jesus wore. We'll get into all that on the program today. Always welcome your calls, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter, Mike Allen Show the handle. We'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. Also, the sports world, I would say even broader than that. Mourning today the death and the passing of Arnold Palmer. Arnold Palmer, who certainly one of the great golfers to ever play the game, but certainly his impact was more than just on the course. And really, he is in many ways the reason for the huge purses, the fan interest, all the rest, because he, as the common man's superstar out of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, the son of a greenskeeper. He had his own army of fans. They loved his swashbuckling style, his self-taught swing, all the rest. Certainly someone larger than life. I think if you make a Mount Rushmore of golf, Arnold Palmer is certainly one of the four faces on it. So maybe we'll get into that a little bit in the second segment anyway, but certainly we pray for eternal rest for his soul, for his family, for particularly his widow and his children. So anyway, rest in peace, Mr. Palmer. I'm a big golf fan, as you know. Like I said, we'll get into that a little bit in the second segment. I was thinking about this yesterday when I was hearing the first reading. In today's reading, we've been in the wisdom literature last week, and we continue on this week. Last week, I think it was Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. This week, a book that is part of the wisdom literature called the Book of Job. As I talked to you before, most people sort of divide the Old Testament down into four basic types of books. You've got the Pentateuch, the Torah, the first five books, books of the law, Pentateuch meaning five scrolls, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, traditionally called the books of Moses. Then you've got what are called the historical books. And those are the books that really, starting with the book of Joshua, tell a narrative history. And if you wanted to put together some sort of a pastiche, so to speak, of Israel's history, you would use these types of books like Joshua and Judges and 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles and so forth. And you could lay out a narrative history of the people of Israel. Then you have the prophetic books, major prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and then into the minor prophets like Malachi, Zephaniah, Zechariah, Obadiah, all the rest. But then you've got the books of wisdom, and the books of wisdom are not historical in the sense of telling a history, but they more look at life through a particular lens and have some significant truths to share. Being an inspired text, as all scripture is, we should open our hearts to the wisdom contained. So two of the historical books, as I said last week, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. This week, we're going to be in the book of Job. Now, I first encountered the book of Job when I was in high school. I had a senior AP English class, and our teacher, it's high school, right? But she called herself Jay Highland Instructor. Just a little pretentious, but she was good. She had us read the book of Job. It's kind of our summer reading. And the idea was we're going to read it as literature. This was a public high school. And evidently, it is considered to be really one of the great literary masterpieces of all time, a very ancient book that dates at least several centuries, maybe sometime between the 7th and the 5th centuries B.C., according to scholars. It's sort of intentionally set in a place that's difficult to discern where it is geographically. And so it's not simply just written as a historical drama, but written really with profound universal human insights and deals with the great vexing human problem that predates the incarnation of Christ that goes back thousands of years, and that is the question of why do human beings suffer as we do? And Job takes that question head on. It is not a new question. That's why, you know, it's always a little bit amazing to me, and maybe I'm too rationalistic when it comes to suffering. Suffering does provoke feelings that go beyond the rational, for sure, but I'm a little bit more, I guess, philosophical about suffering in the sense that, you know, why not me? Everybody else, it seems, throughout history, far better people than me, have suffered unbelievable evil and difficulty and suffering. What somehow makes me special? And yet there is that almost visceral reaction when we suffer some sort of unspeakable pain or unforeseen difficulty that we begin to question. Job, as I said, is a book that seeks to answer that question head on. It's a book that's considered in some ways a theodicy. A theodicy is a defense of God, so to speak. And accusations that may fly against his justice when the apparently good people suffer. Anyway, so Job 1 begins with the situation. One day, you know, the early verses of Job, before we get into I think it begins in verse 6 of chapter 1 today, tells you that there was in the land of Uz a blameless and upright man named Job who feared God and avoided evil. He was a man of great prosperity, both biologically, 7 sons and 3 daughters, but also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-donkeys, a very large household. He was greater than anyone in the East. His sons used to take turns giving feasts, sending invitations to their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was really a picture of bliss, familial, material, you name it. And then you get into today's reading, beginning in verse 6. One day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Sons of God, members of the divine council, the angelic beings, came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan also came among them. Actually, it says the Satan came among them. This is one of the most ancient references to the evil one, the accuser. That's what the name literally means. Satan also came among them. The Lord said to the Satan, "Where have you been?" Now, this is in the actual NAB, in the reading in Mass. I think it has Satan with a capital S, and the one that you link to in the USCCB, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, from the NAB, it has the Satan. That's one of the issues they're working on, I think, cleaning up consistencies between that read in Mass. Anyway, Satan, the accuser, comes from roaming the earth and patrolling it. The Lord brags on his servant Job. "Have you noticed, my servant Job, that there's no one on earth like him? Blameless and upright, fearing God and avoiding evil." But Satan answered the Lord and said, "Is it for nothing that Job is God-fearing? Have you not surrounded him and his family with all that he has with your protection? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his livestock are spread over the land. But put forth your hand and touch anything he has, and surely he will blaspheme you to your face." Satan saying, "Job ain't all that. His love for you is conditional." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, but do not lay hand upon his person." So Satan went forth from the presence of God. So this is where the suffering begins. And Job will be rocked to his core and find himself scrambling to make sense of his faith in a provident God when he, in fact, has been stripped of everything. But I think the question that came to my mind yesterday hearing this read, that came to my mind this morning reading this passage, maybe it was yesterday when I was reading it in advance of today, that what would the devil say about you? What would he say about me in the council of the holy ones as an accuser? What would he bring against me? Or would he even notice me? We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll talk about this more later in the program. This is Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Check out our full range of contributors, every corner of this country and across the heartland at breadboxmedia.com. You can listen to podcasts of old shows, get a sense of the flavor, the perspective, the personality of each contributor, all through the common lens of the Catholic faith, but much, much different too. Very different personalities. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Listen to podcasts through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. Even subscribe. You can become a friend of your show, like Amy did yesterday, becoming a friend of the Mike Allen Show. Thank you, Amy, for that support. And through a monthly contribution, you can receive access to exclusive online content and show your support for the show. So always looking for more friends of the show. Check it out at breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day, just perusing through history, something that happened on this day in 1969 was that Abbey Road, the album from the Beatles, was released. Generally considered, I think, one of the great albums of all time. Maybe not even the best Beatles album, actually, but certainly one of their better albums. And of course, they had such colossal works of vinyl, you know, it's hard to narrow it down. But so I'm asking the question, what is your favorite album of any genre? I can also ask, I guess, a side question. I mean, if you even know what an album is, I guess that all depends upon your age demographic. But do you still have that album? Or, you know, if you could have, I was thinking about another one too, if you could have any album, maybe one that you used to have and somehow you got rid of, or your wife or your mother or your husband or whatever sold to a yard sale or gave to Goodwill without your knowledge, if you could have it back again, what would it be? Or just your favorite album all time of any artist. Some responses we've gotten, by the way, you can send yours, call or text 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Some of the responses we've gotten, Jessica says, Southeastern by Jason Isbell. I'm not even sure who Jason Isbell is, so I'll take your word for it, Jessica. Now you got me curious. Kim says, The Unforgettable Fire by U2. Yeah, definitely good. Shannon says, Hard to Beat, Abbey Road. Lisa says, Abbey Road by the Beatles, one of many. Shannon, lots of greats on that list. Really depends on the mood I'm in. Richard says, Revolver by the Beatles. And John Steven also, Revolver by the Beatles. So if you've got one you want to add a response to, we'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. As I said, call or text, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I was not a huge album listener growing up. Like I said, I think I've told you before, my first album I ever owned was my seventh grade year. I had owned a number of 45 small vinyl records. You see, kids, they used to have these things called records. And I had several 45s, but my first album I received at my birthday / moving away party, my 12th birthday in the seventh grade, was a copy of Fleetwood Mac Rumors. It's an album I no longer have in its vinyl form. I'm pretty sure I've got the CD somewhere, but really, in my mind, one of the great albums of all time. Not a bad song on it. So Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, but probably, if I were to say my favorite album of all time, it's pretty tough to beat Moving Pictures by Rush, in my opinion. 573-4BREAD-4, you can throw your idea in there as well. 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email mikeallenshow@gmail.com or Facebook or Twitter. I think on Twitter, let's see, Mark said London Calling, The Clash is what he would go with. As I said, tragic news in the sports world yesterday. It's actually doubly tragic news. You had Arnold Palmer, who died at the age of 87. Certainly sad. You know, you realize what a gift he was to the sporting world. But, you know, 87, not unexpected, I guess, in some ways. But to have Miami Marlins ace also killed early Sunday morning. Jose Fernandez, 24, one of the really bright young pitchers in the game, I think pitched in the All-Star game, died in a boat crash along with two friends there in the Miami area in the very early hours in a jetty off Miami Beach. Sad indeed, and certainly has rocked Major League Baseball. And, of course, all those impacted by the young man's death, evidently they hit the this jetty, this outcropping of rocks at full speed, and never had a chance, I guess, in that regard. So God's peace for him as well. Speaking of Mr. Palmer, there's an interesting article on ESPN.com this morning, The Force That Drove Arnold Palmer by Ian O'Connor. He basically says, you know, don't be fooled by the image of Arnold Palmer as simply a nice old man who sold you a cool soft drink. And, or as he said, or years after he sold your parents and grandparents motor oil and rental cars. Yes, he was neighborly as a worldwide celebrity could ever be, O'Connor writes. You could easily imagine him lending you his tractor or lawnmower or plowing 8 inches of snow from your driveway if you happen to be away on business. He said, please understand something, though. When you consider the legacy of the late, great 87-year-old man from Latrobe, Pennsylvania, he was a lion long before there was a tiger. He said, like Woods and Michael Jordan and Tom Brady and all the sporting titans defined by their killer game day instincts, Arnold Palmer was a ferocious competitor. Driven, like many of us, he said, to prove his manhood to his hard-driving, hard-drinking father and to prove his worth to the doubters and haters who anticipated nothing more than a life of anonymous mediocrity from the greenkeeper's son. Now, Palmer had tremendous success. I mean, growing up from a relatively modest background, won 62 PGA Tour events, including 7 major championships. And certainly he was not somebody with a classic country club swing. I mean, long before Phil Mickelson gripped it and ripped it, Arnold Palmer was out there with his swashbuckling style and that swing, not ever dialing it back. That was the thing that Palmer's fans, not only, of course, his camaraderie with his fans, but his everyman sort of style. They loved it. But O'Connor says that when he had the opportunity to interview Palmer one time in his modest office near his modest home, he says, off his modest Pennsylvania golf course, he was expected to find this sort of kindly, grandfatherly figure. He said, but Palmer made it painfully obvious that he hated Ben Hogan and that at times he couldn't stand Jack Nicklaus and that he was still angry at Roger Maris for thinking golfers weren't athletes and that he felt he got royally ripped off by the Royal and Ancient Golf Course once in his bid in Great Britain to win a calendar year Grand Slam. As he says, though, more than anything else, Palmer made it clear he feared his old man, Deacon Palmer, who was a functioning alcoholic who dearly loved the oldest of his 4 children and had a difficult time expressing it. Palmer said he lived in the shadow of knowing if he did something wrong, he got his rear kicked, and he never let up. So, you know, you read through this and you hear how he relates, just like they happened yesterday to O'Connor, some of the slights. Like one time when he was, I guess, struggling in a practice round, and he heard Ben Hogan, ask his playing partner, how in the heck did he get into the Masters? Palmer would say it really ticked him off, though he didn't say ticked. He was also furious that Hogan never referred to him by his first name, but called him fella. And you can go on from there. I'm going to post a link to this on the show's Facebook page because it's a pretty fascinating piece. You see these guys, don't ever be fooled. Don't ever be fooled by the exterior, because to play a game like golf, which is the most ruthless game in terms of it rising and falling on the individual gets all the glory, the individual gets all the game. And it's, of course, a game without guaranteed contracts, unless I guess you're talking endorsements. You better have a fire burning within you, and Arnold Palmer certainly didn't. So rest in peace, Mr. Palmer. A couple of other sporting notes, of course. Big football weekend. Minnesota Vikings right now serving notice. I mean, no Teddy Bridgewater, picking up Sam Bradford just before the season begins. Here they sit 3-0. Their defense, phenomenal. My son had the wherewithal to pick Minnesota's defense for his fantasy team, and it's paying off big time. They're sitting 3-0, leading the NFC North. Denver back as the defending Super Bowl champions. No Peyton Manning, no problem. They're sitting at 3-0. Of course, we already told you about New England sitting at 3-0. My Tampa Bay Bucks, sadly enough, dropping a home game to the Rams, and now they've got the Broncos coming in next week. Dallas Cowboys, now they've been helped a little bit by a lighter schedule, but now they're 2-1 with behind Dak Prescott. And, of course, Washington going into New York yesterday with a big win. Big college games, too, including LSU's loss to Auburn, which cost Les Miles his job. He was already on thin ice. We'll give you the What Were You Thinking nominees when we come back from the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Yeah.
show on this Monday, September 26th, the feast day of Saints Cosmas and Damian, both who died under the persecution under Diocletian. So Saints Cosmas and Damian, pray for us. Again, my question of the day, it was on this day in 1969 that the Beatles released their album Abbey Road. My question, what is your favorite album of any artist, any genre, all time? 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text. 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Came across an article from a couple of years ago. I think I linked this on the show's Facebook page. Along with the question of the day, Rolling Stone's top 100 albums of all time. Interestingly enough, Abbey Road is not even make the top two or three in their estimation of Beatles albums. I guess it's third, number 14 all time. I'll give you their quick top 10. Number one, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, number one by the Beatles. Number two, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. Number three, The Beatles, Revolver. So Beatles with two of the three all time. Bob Dylan, Highway 61 Revisited, number four. Oh, no, Rubber Soul. That's also in there at number five. Wow, three of five, the Beatles. Some Beatlephiles putting together this list. So Abbey Road dropping down to fourth among the Beatles albums. Then you've got, let's see, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Then you've got Exile on Main Street. Who is that? I need to look and see. The Clash, London Calling, comes in at number eight. Blonde on Blonde, Dylan, number nine. Nope. The Beatles' White Album, number 10. So Abbey Road, fifth, according to Rolling Stones. Elvis, The Sun Sessions, number 11. Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, number 12. Andy Warhol, or The Velvet Underground, sorry, number 13. And then Abbey Road at 14th. So interestingly, they have Abbey Road. Some other big ones here in the top 20. I'll say top. You got the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Are You Experienced? You've got Nirvana's Nevermind, Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, Michael Jackson's Thriller, and so forth. Stevie Wonder coming in at 24 with Intervisions. My favorite, one of my favorite albums anyway, Fleetwood Mac coming in, The Rumors at number 26, and The Joshua Tree for U2 at 27. So anyway, you can check it out yourself if you want to follow the link. But if you want to call me and let me know your favorite album, any genre, any artist all time, 573-4BREAD-4. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, let's move on now to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. Again, spanning the globe. Never seemed to be any shortage. First nominee, since we just talked about sports, we're going to give to the University of Georgia. The University of Georgia, who, of course, unceremoniously ran Mark Richt, their football coach, out of town after last year, despite the fact that Mark Richt had a higher winning career percentage as a coach than a guy who was a legend at Georgia, Vince Dooley. Vince Dooley, who won fewer games percentage-wise than Richt, but had the completely fortunate opportunity to coach Mr. Herschel Walker, who led Georgia to their only national championship. And it seems like when you win one, you think you should win it every year. So they run Mark Richt out on a rail. They go after the highly coveted assistant under Nick Saban, Kirby Smart. And Georgia, after struggling to beat Nicholls State, barely beating Missouri, and Missouri faced a harsh reality at Ole Miss and lost 45-14. So all I would say to you Georgia fans is, how's that working out for you? Meanwhile, I think Miami is undefeated under Coach Mark Richt. Now, I know the pushback is, oh, well, you know, just wait till Kirby Smart gets his recruits. Well, you know, Mark Richt, over the tenure of his career, on average, was the second best recruiting class in the SEC, and typically, I think, averaged about sixth or seventh nationally in the recruiting rankings. So is Kirby Smart going to do better than that? Here's your problem, Georgia. You took a big gamble. You hired a guy who'd never been a head coach. So we'll see. Maybe it'll work out for you, but I'm giving you the What Were You Thinking Award for what you did to Mark Richt, and then going and hiring a coordinator, and Ole Miss teaching you a hard lesson over the weekend. Our number two nominee is going to have to go to the Saudi Arabian airline pilot. This was out of the Manila in the Philippines. The flight crew of a Saudi Arabian Airlines plane mistakenly pressed a hijack warning button twice as it approached Manila's airport on Tuesday, causing airport officials to mobilize security forces and isolate the jet after it landed. Evidently, the flight from Jeddah made the distress call about 20 miles from the airport. Airport authorities asked for a verification of the emergency message, and the flight crew confirmed the distress call, he said. It's not immediately clear how the confirmation was made, but internationally known emergency codes were used by both the flight crew and control tower. But the captain later told the control tower a button indicating a hijacking was in progress, that it was pushed accidentally. Despite the assurance, airport authorities quickly convened a crisis committee. I mean, if there's a possibility of pushing a hijack indicator button, shouldn't it kind of like require maybe like a little cover it over or something? Something that makes it a little bit harder to accidentally push the hijack button. So I'm not sure who the, what were you thinking, whether it's the pilot or whether it's the designer of the control pad or whatever on this plane. Evidently, there were passengers on board, I guess, who were getting phone calls from family and friends saying that they had heard a report the plane had been hijacked. That's a call you don't want to get. Anyway, so that's our second nominee. But our winner, we're going to give to the store my sister affectionately refers to as Target. Target. Go dumb or go home. This from Consumerist magazine. Target ends kitty cart experiment after children terrorize parents and stores. Evidently, Target recently decided to give mini shopping carts a try in a few dozen stores in Minnesota and New York and removed them after only a month. These were little tiny shopping carts to be pushed by children. They said, "We briefly tested kitty cars at 72 Target stores," a spokeswoman said, "and after reviewing guest and stores' feedback, we made the decision to stop the test." Evidently, these children were wreaking havoc in Target, running over people's ankles and ramming people with these carts. All they had to do, Target, was talk to my mother. Man, those few times when I was a kid, my mom would let me push the big grocery cart. Many a time, she would wear sandals. I'd run right over her heel. Oh, those were not good. So Target had to learn a hard lesson. I don't know what you're going to do with those little shopping carts now, Target, but keep them away from the aisles of your stores. Anyway, if you've got a nominee, I would love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Followed a little bit of the unfolding events in Charlotte, I guess, over the weekend after the shooting death last week of Keith Lamont Scott and the protests that erupted in the African-American community particularly. And the video first was released, cell phone video footage by Keith Lamont Smith's wife, and then which prompted the police department there in Mecklenburg County and Charlotte to release their own video of the shooting. Of course, the dispute has been whether Keith Lamont Smith whether he had a gun at all or whether he was holding a book, whether he pointed and acted as if he was going to shoot. I have to say, the video is fairly inconclusive in terms of what he may be holding in his left hand. You really can't see anything. But I will say this, watching the video, which is disturbing, obviously, because you see a man dying, gunned down there before your very eyes. I will say that the gentleman did not raise his arm as if he were going to shoot. It's difficult for me. And again, I'm just a layman here, but it sure is difficult for me to look at that video and see how multiple gunshots that ended the man's life were necessary. I know. I'm not law enforcement. I was not in that situation. But you see a scene like that, to me, it's pretty difficult to justify what law enforcement did in that situation. I saw an article on EWTN News, actually, about a Charlotte priest, Father Patrick Winslow, who is a priest there at a Catholic church in Charlotte's University City neighborhood, less than a mile, really, away from this shooting and all the protests. Father Patrick Winslow told EWTN News what he would say to his people there in the parish. I think they need to hear a simple message of prayer, of charity, and reassurance. We're called to be a light in the midst of many darknesses in this world. He's Father Winslow, very much even-handed. He says, we're probably 500 yards from the shooting. This is our neighborhood. He said he was aware of the different experiences of different people in the neighborhood. He said the African-American community is going to feel differently than the university kids across the street versus all the other different people in the area. He would not make a judgment, but he says he feels a great deal of compassion for the family who lost someone they love and compassion for all those families who have people in law enforcement wounded as a result of the violence and protests. He said, I think many who have not experienced prejudice and bigotry would be surprised by the experience of those who experience it regularly. And those who experience it regularly might be surprised there are many who are not bigoted in their thoughts. So, sounds like a faithful shepherd in the midst of that difficulty. We'll be back with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Monday, September 23rd, feast day of Saints Cosmas and Damian. Love to hear from you this morning if you want to comment on anything we've discussed or if you want to answer the question of the day, which is on the 47th anniversary of the release of the Beatles album Abbey Road, which according to Rolling Stone is 14th album of all time, any artist, any genre, 14th best, but only 5th best in the records from the Beatles. So my question is, what's your favorite album of all time? 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. So we were talking about there at the end of that last segment, and by the way, I did post that link on the show's Facebook page to the article about Arnold Palmer, and like I said, not to be fooled by the iced tea and lemonade drinking, twinkly-eyed, tender-hearted old gentleman that understand that back in the day particularly, and even late into his life, Arnold Palmer was driven within himself with an insatiable hunger to prove himself to all the naysayers and the doubters, and it's part of what drove him, for sure. A very interesting window into the soul of Mr. Palmer, who passed away yesterday. May he rest in Christ's peace. Big debate, of course, tonight. The first of, I think, 4 debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald J. Trump seeking the presidency of the United States. You know, that there have been a lot of hand-wringing. There's been a lot of frustration about the choices that we have before us in terms of this presidential race from the two major parties. Yes, I know there are other candidates. Gary Johnson, who's now talking about, colonizing outer space. So, these alternative candidates look really, really good until you actually start investigating them and you see that maybe the only thing they have going for them is that they're not Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. So it's a tough one. And as I've said before, at this point, I cannot vote for either major party candidate. But I will say the only entertaining part of the race will be these debates, it sure seems like the anticipation is. Yes, I know they're going up tonight against Monday Night Football, but, you know, I forget who the teams are that are playing tonight. It's it's kind of small shakes, really, in terms of who you would put up against a debate like this. So some are anticipating it'll be one of the most highly watched television events in history. You know, it's that like rubbernecking at a car accident scene. You just, for whatever reason, people want to see it. And so I'll be at my son's junior varsity football game tonight. I'll probably catch some of it on the radio on the way back. But we'll see. I think the debates could have a big impact on a race that has become increasingly tight. I don't know if you've got a feeling about it. We'll certainly talk about it some tomorrow. We'll have to catch the highlights if I don't get to see it live. Yeah, Atlanta and New Orleans. I mean, Atlanta's 1-1 tonight. New Orleans 0-2. A choice between that game and Trump versus Clinton in the debate. It's a no-brainer, and I love football. So we'll keep an eye on that for sure as it unfolds. Said it earlier, mentioned it too, if you've got an opinion on the Charlotte situation. Watch these videos is very disturbing. As I said, I know I'm not law enforcement, and I know, you know, part of what complicates this, of course, is that I believe the officer who shot Keith Lamont Smith, or at least one of them, was African-American, I think the police chief. So it's not, you know, it's not simply a race thing, but we have this increased, and then maybe, you know, part of it is the increased violence in our culture. Police feel like they have to be more ready to shoot when necessary. But watching that video, to me, unless somebody can call and explain what I'm not seeing, it sure seems difficult to justify the killing of the man. Again, that's just me. So give me a call if you want. Looking forward to my class today. We're going to be talking some about I had them do on a Friday. I told you Friday, you know, I had the opportunity to go play in our Catholic diocese has an annual golf tournament. And thanks to generosity of some friends, thanks Peggy and Steve, got to play in a foursome. Well, we ended up being a two and a halfsome, because me, one of our four did not show up. So we had two guys and then myself. And you know, if you ever meet me, you'll wonder, man, he sure seems stiff in the neck. Maybe I'm like Israel, you know, who are called a stiff-necked people. It's my own stubbornness of will. I'm sure that's true as well. But I also have this arthritic disease that's in the same family as rheumatoid. So it makes it increasingly hard to move my neck up and down or side to side. So been a while since I'd play golf, and I think I didn't realize how much mobility I'd lost because I was pretty much useless off the tee. Fortunately, and this is always the key with when you play in a scramble like this, we had a guy in our scramble who could knock the cover off of the ball. So we just kind of, you know, let him carry us, which he did. I did. My claim to fame was I did hit a 20-foot putt to give us our first birdie. And we did not finish in last, which most of the teams I've played on over the years have finished in last, so that was nice. But anyway, while I was gone from my class, because, you know, I had to go take one for the team and play golf at this event, so, you know, in that suffering, I had to allow my class to be taught by a substitute teacher. But basically, I broke them into groups, and one of the things that I did, I don't know if you've ever heard of a genogram. You know, a genogram is sort of a chart meant to illustrate your family history. It's like a family tree, but it's a little bit more detailed, and it details other, you know, areas of, you know, whether you have a divorce, whether you have, relationships of some sort, you know, non-marital sexual relationships, children born of those unions, conflictual relationships. I mean, there's really no limit to what you can do with a genogram. You lay it out, and there are different types. There are genograms of medical histories, for example, in your biological family tree. But the one that I did was simply a genogram just on terms of interrelationships. And I had them do a genogram. I gave them good instructions, of course. I had them do a genogram on the patriarch Jacob. And I had them go, tell them they had to go back to Jacob's parents and siblings, and then ahead to Jacob's own immediate descendants, his children. Jacob, one of the great patriarchs of Israel, right? The, you know, he was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I told them, you need to, you know, I gave them the chapters in Genesis to read and give themselves plenty of room, because it is a complex family genogram. You talk about putting the fun in dysfunction. Jacob's family, it's pretty remarkable. And as is the case in the book of Genesis, and we were talking about this last Friday with Jason Hall, if you'll recall, you know, the case in the book of Genesis is that there is no really moral commentary in the book of Genesis. This is before the law of Moses is given, which would come in Exodus. But there's just more of a portrayal of this is where these types of things always end up. So we've said that great quote about Genesis from Leon Cass, Genesis is not just about what happened, it's about what always happens. And certainly in Genesis, when you see the kind of things that go on in the family dynamic, I mean, take Jacob, for instance. He meets the woman that he wants to be his wife, Rachel. Of course, she's got a sister, Leah. By the way, they're the daughters of his uncle, meaning they're the cousins. Again, it's Wild West, right? So Jacob gets drunk at his own wedding, and his father foists Leah upon him. Jacob marries her, not realizing it's Leah until he sobers up. Then he ends up having the opportunity to also marry Rachel, and then Leah and Rachel, shockingly enough, don't get along. And there's great enmity between them, and of course, they get into a baby-making contest. Actually, in the ancient world, you know, a woman derived her sense of, I guess, self-worth by whether she was able to conceive, as well as whether she had the blessing of God. And so Leah has four children. Rachel is apparently sterile, invites Jacob to have relations with her maidservant, produces two children. Leah, who is now unable to conceive, has Jacob do the same with her maidservant. You end up with this quite interesting combination ends up being, let's see, 12 sons and one daughter by four different women. And in the midst of all that, of course, you've got all kind of crazy things, like Jacob's oldest son with his wife, Leah, then having a sexual relationship with his half-brother's mother, Leah's own maidservant, Zilpah. One of the things I wanted them to see in the midst of all this, not only, of course, some perspective of if they think there's somehow family is a hindrance to their success in life, or particularly into their spiritual success, but to see how God, in the midst of all this craziness, how he was able to perform his great work of redemption, even through this line of people who, as I said, put the fun, or maybe you could say they took the fun out of dysfunction, because wasn't a lot of fun in the interrelationships in that family. Just ask Joseph, by the way. It is Genesis. Man, what a great book. But maybe I'll post my own particular version of the genogram sometime here this week, maybe on the Friend of the Show page. We'll be back in a minute with a new hour. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.